I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. A 3-year-old boy was killed in a drive-by shooting this weekend. Denzel Sanderson was with his family outside the home in South Central L.A. when a late model Jeep Cherokee drove up. Several men jumped out shooting. Young Denzel was killed. 4 others were wounded. These people's lives will now be added to the frightening statistics of death that are now the mark of South Los Angeles. Last year alone, there were over 600 people killed by violent crime. And in most cases, it involves black Americans taking the lives of other black Americans. Reverend Eugene Rivers from Boston is just back from a visit to California. He was talking with black preachers and the police officers there about what can be done to stop the killing. And Connection listeners, we'd like you in on the conversation this hour. Who do you think is to blame for the wave of black-on-black homicide that is gripping Los Angeles and other cities throughout America? Is it the politicians, the police, or leaders of the communities where the crimes are committed who should be held responsible? And what can the churches and the church leaders do to help stop the violence? Our number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Now, Boston's Reverend Eugene Rivers was himself once a gang member. He's the founder of the National 10-Point Leadership Coalition, a group of church and community leaders credited with helping reduce the murder rate in Boston. He's also pastor of the Azusa Christian Community and an outspoken advocate of using churches to help kids who get caught up in street violence. And he's with me in the studio. Welcome back to The Connection.
Thank you.
Gene, you're also just back from California. Tell me what you were seeing and what you were hearing while you were out there this past week.
This past week, I was in a series of meetings with grassroots community activists, clergy. Was in a meeting with Chief Bill Bratton and young people. And I was taken around one of the most challenging districts in Los Angeles. You have 4 heavy-hitter, high-intensity districts, Southeast, Southwest, Newton, and 77th Street. And the overwhelming majority of black-on-black violence that takes place in the city occurs in the areas that I've just referred to. And so we were in meetings, and one gets the sense that there is a tectonic shift taking place in terms of the thinking much of the leadership in Los Angeles. For example, I had a meeting with a very remarkable black leader in Los Angeles, John Mack, who is head of the Los Angeles Urban League, which is a remarkable institution. And one of the things that was striking was that Mr. Mack said, there's got to be new thinking and a greater sense of ownership and recognition that while on the one hand, we can't have the police running roughshod over the communities. There must be some clear recognition among all involved that the black community must now take greater ownership in a very systematic way when you have the kind of unbelievable violence that happens routinely. I'm in Los Angeles, and they tell me that the preceding weekend, or maybe 2 weekends ago, there were 16 shootings and 10 murders over a weekend. That's absolutely phenomenal. And my thinking is that, you know, if the United States can go to Iraq and, wipe up the terrorists and engage in shock and awe, and then Halliburton and company can rebuild the entire country to the tune of $100 billion. If we can do that outside of the United States, certainly we can mobilize resources in this country and the communities from which these young people come. The leadership can engage in focusing on this issue in a much more systematic way because...
You talked about a tectonic shift, though. So what's got people focused on it? This isn't new. This didn't just start in February. I mean, this has been going on a long, long time.
Well, there's a new political dialogue. You're absolutely correct. This has been going on for years. In fact, there was a minor cottage industry of movies that were spun out of Los Angeles, Boys in the Hood. I mean, the whole Boys in the Hood genre of movies. I think what has happened are 2 things. One, you've got new leadership surfacing 2 different ways. Bill Bratton coming to Los Angeles.
Police chief. New police chief in police LA. Chief, from New York, yeah, from right. Boston.
Right? Chief of Police William J. Bratton has come to L.A. and has said, we're going to do things in a new way. And I think that that was that's a remarkable breath of fresh air for the city. That's on the law enforcement side. On the other side, Bishop Charles E. Blake, the pastor of the West Angeles Cathedral in L.A., as a black religious leader, said, we're now going to go in a new direction, and we're going to explore some new ideas. There have been ideas bouncing around for the last 20 years because the issue is new. We're now going to try some new models and test some new approaches to addressing this.
All right, let's bring Jill Iovi into the conversation now. She's an L.A. Times reporter, and she's been actually writing an ongoing series called Mortal Wounds, chronicling the stories of black-on-black murders in Los Angeles. She's joining us on the phone from L.A. Hi, Jill.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thanks a lot for joining us.
Hi, Jill.
Hi, Reverend.
Jill, I notice that what you do with your stories is you really focus on the people. You're not trying to find connections to gangs. You're just saying, this is what it's like for a mother to discover the body of her son outside her home. This is what it's like for a father to pull back the sheet in a morgue. It's a very specific approach you've taken. Tell me why you're doing that.
Well, I think that we tend to see every part of homicide except the part that's hardest to look at, and that's the searing, excruciating pain of homicide. And you know, that's sort of the beacon of my stories. I try to cover the pain because I think that on the one hand, if there's suffering out there and it's being ignored, that's a terrible thing. Suffering deserves recognition. And I also think the suffering sort of guides you. The suffering tells you how to look at the issue. It starts with the victims. It's always about the victims.
I wonder if you are also quite precise in the language that you use in your stories, because so often this type of killing is gang killing, or, you know, it's sort of, and then it's put in a certain part of the newspaper. Are you looking to change some of the language that we use in referring to this type of death?
Well, I try to cover what I see and what I hear in the most direct way, and my stories try to reflect that. If you're talking about the fact that I don't identify victims as gang members in stories, I mean, sometimes I do that, and I do it explicitly to this extent that I find that in my reporting, but the truth of the matter is that it usually is much, much more ambiguous than it sometimes would appear when you are looking at this from a distance. It turns out that he was a gang member, and he was also a beloved son, and he was also that kid who played in Little League and did well in school up to a certain point. People are complicated, and there are many things to many people, and you find that when you start talking in depth to their families and the people who loved them.
You've also chosen, Jill, to write about black-on-black violence. Is that because that's the violence, those are the stories that are so easily ignored?
I write about black-on-black violence because of the numbers, and the numbers are just so clear and so stark, and I think L.A. is actually a good city for this because we're a mostly Latino city, and our black population is down near 10 or 11%, and yet black victims are about, I think, 41, 42% of our homicide victims now. So it's actually not a wave of black-on-black violence. It's disproportionate black death. And, you know, when you have those kind of numbers, the numbers matter. That's each of those is a life, and that's a measure of suffering out there. And I do think, you know, when I was doing interviews this summer and through the fall, one of the things that I found in family after family after family after family that I interviewed is that, I'd say about a third of the time at some point during the interview or in a subsequent interview, a mother or father would say to me, and I'm a white reporter, would say, you know, black people love their children too. And It just makes you want to cry. It says so much about how ignored people feel and how dehumanized they feel and how much they feel that their suffering is overlooked, that they would feel the need to say, you know, black people love their children too, to a white reporter.
Gene Rivers, you hear this in cities other than L.A. as well.
What's interesting, as I've been listening and learning in Los Angeles, because a lot of the time that I've spent in L.A., I just, you know, going around with the police, talking to residents that live there for years. Across the country, You go to Baltimore. In fact, Baltimore now has a TV series spun off around the crime and violence in Baltimore, The Wired on HBO. You go to Baltimore, you go to Detroit, you go to Philly, you go to Chicago. There's a fairly consistent theme that you see when you go into these cities, especially into the poor neighborhoods. And there are one of the things that happens in every one of the cities, there is this consistent theme of the absence of responsible male adults in the lives of the children. You go to Baltimore, hang out on the corners there. You go to any of these cities, and you get conversation. You go into the barbershops, and you listen to the men, you know, talk about what's going on, the old-timers, right? Consistently, you will hear, just sort of anecdotally, and if one did an ethnography like Eli Anderson out of Penn, you'd see that, for me, politically, I'm experiencing the sins of the fathers being visible in the second and third generation. In an odd way, we are now seeing the chickens come home to roost on a community. Daniel Moynihan said back in 65 that much of this, there were all the economic factors, but the family, and in particular, the role of men and fathers in the community, really affected the development of these black communities. Moynihan in 65 was criticized as a racist. He was run out of town, and he was maligned. You know, 40 years later, we now have to, you know, almost 40 years later, 38 years later, we now have to confront the fact that he was onto something. And what I'm seeing as I spend time in the neighborhoods, and I'm, you know, I'm a black person talking to other black folk, they are asking, listen, we need to develop a new movement that would mobilize
something to replace the fathers who aren't there.
Yeah, absolutely. And in other words, there's got to be there's got to be a new movement where men will adopt a generation of de facto orphans that exist on the streets. It doesn't take...
You're talking about orphans who are 15, 16, 17 years old as well. You're not just talking about little kids.
No, I'm talking about both. We've got to start now, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years old, focusing on kids that have been neglected and don't have responsible male authority figures in their lives to provide the kind of direction that all children need developmentally, regardless of what their race is.
And are you talking about something that has to come from the churches or something that could come from the secular part of society?
Well, let's talk about that, right? Because that's a big hubbub, the business. See, I talk about churches because they are the one institution that is pervasive as a real institutional presence in every major black community of the country. And they're a major resource which are underutilized. When you talk to Bishop Charles Blake in California, he says, listen, we have got to get more of the black churches involved in intercepting these young people working in collaboration with law enforcement. So this is a new model and a new paradigm that faith communities would collaborate at the street level to intercept these kids. So we're talking about a generation of kids, and this has been going on for 30 years now. So in the case of Los Angeles, you've got this intergenerational phenomena of dudes who are gang members that are 50, 60 years old, and young kids that are being inducted into these gangs.
All right, we'll come back after the break and talk further about this. My chance to say thanks to Jill Iovi for joining us. Jill's a reporter with the L.A. Times, and Jill, I appreciate your time this morning.
Sure, no problem.
And also a note for Connection listeners, the series that Jill has been writing, Mortal Wounds, will have a link on our website to that. You can take a look at some of the stories that she's been writing and the people that she's been meeting. Connection listeners, 1-800-423-8255. Some thoughts from you on black-on-black violence and society's responsibility. Are the politicians dropping the ball? Are the black leaders dropping the ball? What do you think? I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Our number's 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255 to join this conversation with Reverend Eugene Rivers, pastor of the Azusa Christian Community in Dorchester, Massachusetts, and founder of the National 10-Point Leadership Coalition of Churches and Community Leaders that's credited with a pretty dramatic reduction of violence in Boston over the last 11 years. And Gene Rivers has been spending time lately out in L.A., and I think that we should probably go back there to the last thing that Jill Iovi said, because I wanted to hear you respond to that. And there's something pretty sick about a country where black parents say to a white reporter, you know, we love our children, too. Yeah. Like it has to be stated?
Yeah. Yes. There have been some fairly dramatic changes in what we understand the black community to be over the last 30 years. And Jill's point is actually well taken. Let's talk about analytic frameworks concisely. You see, much of the violence and the culture of violence, the gangster, thug life, pimps and hoes, patois of a certain wing of hip-hop is a logical outgrowth of the decline of a paleo-liberal integrationist kind of policy framework, which was the dominant...
Say that in English. No.
You know, in other words, there was a civil rights movement which morphed into a civil rights industry that traded in the political discourse of rights to the exclusion of responsibilities.
Not really talking about the people who needed help, but just talking about it as a bit of liberal philosophy?
More, what the broader societies should do for the black community, with less emphasis on what black people should do for the black community. So we have a rights-based discourse that says, you know, we need to have an expanded menu of programs that are developed for us as opposed to programs developed by us for us. So you have this discourse that's rooted in the history of the civil rights movement.
This is the shift from victimhood to responsibility.
There you go.
Right?
So it's a victim rights-based discourse.
Right.
Now what happens in the shadows of the decline of that discourse, which no longer has the moral and intellectual currency that it had 20 years ago, you now have emerging in the aftermath of the decline of, you know, do it for me, white folk owe us, the emergence of this culture of violence because the gangster rap it follows as a logical outgrowth of the decline of the political and intellectual orientation of the established black leadership. So young black people say, and I had a remarkable conversation with Reginald Hudlin and Byron Phillips, who are young folk in the entertainment industry. They said, listen, none of these young thugs out here and these young people relate to the old school liberal, you know, civil rights establishment. It's a new paradigm. It's a new framework. It's a new worldview. Now, how do we develop a language which effectively speaks to a generation who were born in some cases 10 years after the death of Martin Luther King, who don't understand the images, the icons, or the symbols?
So you're going to grab that 18, 19-year-old kid by the scruff of the neck and sit him down in the pew of a church and say, you're going to listen to me talk about God? Is he going to be any more interested in that?
Absolutely not. Well, first of all, no one who is an experienced youth worker thinks that you're going to take any bona fide thug and bring him into the church and give him a Sunday school lesson. Because most of these dudes aren't having it, and they shouldn't, because in too many cases, the church has not meant much to them. Mm-hmm. What we're talking about is the reverse. See, it's not a case of the church is engaging in inreach. We now must, in the case of L.A., this is what's going to happen, must partner with the law enforcement community to go into the most violent neighborhoods and meet these young people where they live. In other words, there is a...
But if the cops only show up when there's a body on the street, that's
right,
not the time for the black leader to show up with the cop and say, isn't that too bad? This shouldn't happen.
Absolutely.
The black leader needs to be there before the bullets fire.
Well, absolutely. And to the extent to which the black leadership across the country in the various cities did not provide those kind of connections, we have the problem that we have.
Right.
In fact, the police show up in part because someone didn't do their job within the community. So by the time that, you know, Johnny or James or Eugene gets caught by the police, there are a number of institutions and individuals that should have intercepted him. Our failure to have done that effectively results in officer so-and-so intercepting the kid. So what we're saying is, let's now flip the script. And in Los Angeles, we're in conversations with a broad array of community-based leaders to talk about some new models for intercepting the young person before they get caught up in the mix and developing a grassroots strategy, which is multifaceted.
Before we go too far into that, though, give me a good example. You're saying be there first.
Yeah.
So say it's you. Say you're on the street.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's some kid who's just hanging out. Maybe he's with a gang. Maybe he's not. He's got not a lot to do.
Right.
He doesn't have a father figure at home.
Sure.
And you're saying to me that with the clever, thoughtful kind of intervention, you can give him some kind of meaning to his life that it'll get him out of that street gangster culture. What's your opening line? What do you say to him?
Well, see, let's go there. That kid, as tough as he may be on paper, is looking for love, firm discipline, and authority. And he wants the second two, because the first, disconnected from the second two, is mush. I get love from mom. I get love from mom till I'm 13, 14. I get too big for mom to spank, and then I'm on my own, right? I need a responsible, powerful adult male in my life, and I need some discipline and some concern. Now, I'm saying to you that you can take the most violent kid in Baltimore, Philadelphia, L.A., Compton, and if you work consistently to develop a relationship with that young man, you're going to turn that young man's life around. Now.
What's your opening line? What are you going to say to him? What's the first thing that's going to get his attention? You're a stranger. You're coming up to him on the street.
Let me give an example. Yesterday, in fact, I visit a Department of Youth Services facility, talking to a young man that's got a fairly significant reputation for being a high-impact player in the game. The first thing we sit down and talk about is, what does this young man want to do with his life? And I say to the young man, listen, I'm not your mother. I'm not going to breastfeed you. And if you decide to make it a bad decision, I'm not going to lose any sleep over that. You're a young man. You're intelligent. You're a player. You're on the come up. Now, young brother, what do you want to do with your life? Now, mind you, I'm not here to sell you anything or to hustle you. And I'm not going to be hustled by you. However, if 5 years from now you'd like to be alive and you want to do something with your life other than take gunshots and give them, we can do something. But mind you, brother, this is your decision, because ultimately in life, partner, decision's destiny. What happens in your life ultimately comes down to decisions that you make. Now, that is a responsibility-based conception of engaging in political discourse with young people who want to talk about realistically and be challenged. But it's our failure. In too many cases, the men have not been properly engaging the lives of these young people. And where I get that information is from the young people. The young man told me yesterday, no one has systematically reached out to me. I'm a wild dude off the hook with the wire cut because no men were effective and strong enough and intervened in my life. Same thing in L.A.
1-800-423-8255 for you to join us. Now we're going to go to Outer Banks, South Carolina. Al's joining us. Hi, Al.
Hi.
Thanks for calling.
Yeah, no problem.
What do you think?
What do I think? Well, I don't really think. I feel. Everything that's going on is making me feel. I'm tired of thinking. I'm tired of hearing other people's thoughts. People thinking too much and doing nothing. People that say they're involved, they drive their BMWs, they drive their nice cars, they go home to their nice homes, and they sleep well. We need people involved at the talking tables that are involved in the situation.
Who are these people in their BMWs? What are you talking about, Al?
People who are not experienced at what's going on out here.
Everyone's
calling the shots. We need some people who have been out here in this, involved in it, who have turned themselves around. This problem goes back, way back. It goes back to when black people were disallowed to deal with each other. They were separated by the tones of their skin during slavery. We haven't got along since then.
Okay, so 2003, where are we now, though? Are you saying that it's still...
I think it's turning around. It's turning around. But we have people that don't want to give up on some of these luxuries and things that they've gained in order to bring other people up. It's like crabs in a barrel.
You're talking about the differences between white and black America? You're talking about wealthy black Americans not willing to help out as well?
I'm talking about people and people. This is spread into the white community, too. The portraying that we do on the TV about black people, it's spreading right into the white community. You can see it. And it's going to bring them down just like it's bringing everything else down. So we got to address it as a whole, as a people on earth. We can't separate. It's not just black. It's got to go beyond that.
So life
and we got the preachers telling us one thing, and there's so many churches on every corner in this country, and none of them love each other. Love is the answer. So, I mean, we need to talk about things that are really real, not just keep going around the bushes. We need to love one another, and love is the answer. And we won't do it unless we come together, and the churches are not coming together. They're preaching against one another. They have different doctrines, and they're competing with fashion and cars and who's got this, who's got that. They're not going to get what's real. Some churches are doing very good. Don't get me wrong.
All right. Gene Rivers is nodding here. I want to let him in. Gene?
Brother, first of all, I agree with you completely that there's a lot of there's a lot of show and flash in the church. But here again, that's not new. 50 years ago, 60 years ago, there was a lot of flash in the black church. But even with that, the churches were able to mobilize, and a young man by the name of Martin Luther King, who was an unknown, who was a no-name, moved from Atlanta to Montgomery and began to organize inauspiciously, and a new movement emerged. Almost 50 years later now, we've got to develop a new movement, which focuses now on the internal. 50 years ago, it was white guys with white sheets. Now we got young brothers, black dudes with black hoods, you know, who are preying on many in our community. Now, this is not to say that the vast majority of young black people aren't law-abiding citizens, as they are. Clearly, 90% of the black kids in every community are law-abiding kids. 90% of black folk are law-abiding, hard-working citizens. So let's get that clear so we don't have a round of goofy conversations around that issue.
And there's some good black fathers out there,
and too. And there are thousands, millions of good black fathers out there. However, that's not our problem. And what we're talking about tonight, this morning, this afternoon, is the problem. What do we do when we're 10 to 11% of the population of a city, but we commit 41% of the homicides? That's the challenge we have before us. And in Los Angeles, we have an interesting story because Los Angeles is a microcosm of black America. If we can't win LA, then it's not clear that what we'll be able to do with other cities. So the battle for Los Angeles is a critical referendum on black leadership, and in particular, black church leadership. And it's true, there's a church in every corner. Now, the challenge is now to mobilize as many of those churches. The majority of black churches during the civil rights movement were not active in the movement. So let's not labor under the illusion that, you know, the majority of black churches were there. In fact, some of the most virulent opposition that Martin Luther King had came from the National Baptist Convention, which invited him to leave and which resulted in the starting of the Progressive Baptist Convention. So it's okay. We don't need the majority of anybody because it's always been a prophetic remnant that has made the critical difference in every major social movement in the U.S.
All right, Al, thanks a lot for your call. 1-800-423-8255. Next to Raleigh, North Carolina, Francis is joining us. Hi, Francis.
Yes, good morning. A very timely topic. While listening to the program, I've got a question for your guest. It seems as though you're moving towards eliminating this violent element in black society, either by reforming it or incarcerating it. I wasn't able to hear the whole text of your program. Is that what you're talking about?
What we're talking about is ministering, mentoring, and monitoring.
All right, may I interrupt you right there?
Sure.
Let me say, having been on the other side of this problem.
What side specifically, Francis?
Well, let's just say that during my time served overseas, this business of thuggery is certainly not new to the United States. With that regard, this element of thuggery looks upon that helping hand that you offer as an affirmation of your weakness and your ability to be manipulated.
So what are you saying, beat them up or lock them up?
Well, let me put it to you this way. If the sight of one's comrade with a well-placed bullet hole through the forehead does not somehow or another gain the attention of your hopeful penitent, very little else will. And you have in your society, as we're starting to see here in the larger cities of North Carolina, some already we have drive-by shootings in our sister city of Durham.
Francis, I'm not being flip. What do you think the answer is?
Well, let me put it to you this way. My solution is to come down a great deal harder on the hardcore criminal element and make their lives the same way you get rid of rats and cockroaches in your home. You deny them the food source. You deny them the ability to nest. You deny them the ability to multiply. You make that environment so incredibly intolerable that they will leave and they will keep moving until they find no succor and no no safe yeah. harbor, and then they are faced with either the bullet through the forehead or stepping back into the realm of man and behaving like civilized human beings.
Well, let me, two things. I want to come to the issue of suppression. I'm a bit troubled by the language because I don't think it's necessary to make the point. I mean, the bullet through the forehead and the analogizing to rats and cockroaches, well, I am, as a black preacher, you know, not indifferent to flamboyant language, as more than a few folk know. However, in this case, what you've said is how do we, there's a certain criminal element, which is a minority. And frankly, violent criminals need to be suppressed in English. There needs to be a clear, fair, aggressive suppression of violent behavior when young men, and this, in the vast majority of cases, young men, present a visible, tangible, verifiable threat to a social order. They need to be suppressed. And in certain cases, they'd be incarcerated. And we shouldn't blink from that. Now, we should engage in giving them the carrot of jobs and a range of opportunities and work to make that available.
Francis is saying when you put that hand out, though, that's an affirmation of their bad behavior.
Well, not necessarily. Not necessarily. Listen, 9 out of 10 young people in any poor neighborhood, 9 out of 10 young people are good. You extend the hand to those 9 kids and create an opportunity for them to go the right way. You may have one, that 10th kid, that's just Bobby Bad Butt, who thinks he's going to be a criminal because he thinks it's about thug life. The thug who is violent, who acts out, who presents a threat to the neighborhood and the community should be suppressed and or incarcerated. End of story. And I think it is the growing awareness within the black religious community that not only must we love, you know, and extend the carrot, but there must be a recognition and an affirmation that in certain contexts, there's got to be an aggressive, firm suppression of violence.
Which Connection, listeners, is what brings church leaders and police officers together in looking at the problem of black-on-black violence in America today. When we come back after the break, the chief of police in Los Angeles, William J. Bratton, will be joining us with his view on the situation there. And, of course, we want you to stay with us on the program here by listening in or calling in. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. This hour conversation about black-on-black violence. Certainly the city of Los Angeles is one place in America where that is a significant problem for the people who live there, for the law enforcement people, for the church people. I have with me here in the studio Eugene Rivers, pastor of the Azusa Christian Community in Dorchester, Massachusetts, and founder of the 10-Point Leadership Coalition of churches and community leaders. Joining us now on the line from Los Angeles, Chief of Police William J. Bratton. Welcome to The Connection.
Good morning. Good to be with you, Eugene. Good morning.
Good morning, Chief.
Earlier in the program, Bill, Gene was talking about some new ideas that you're trying to make work to break this cycle of black-on-black violence. What would you say is the one that you like, the one that you think is working?
Well, Gene mentioned the three M's, the mentoring, ministering, and monitoring, and the area that I have to focus on, that's the responsibility of the police, is the enforcement component. So you got three M's and an E, but none of those four elements by themselves are going to work. But what's exciting, we've seen success in Boston and some other cities around the country with the community policing model, which is emphasis on partnership, the partnering between those four components. Ministers, mentors, monitors, probation, parole, and enforcement, the police. It's that combination of strengths and expertise that can give us a tipping point in certain cities. And Boston, I think, certainly saw the benefit of that in the mid-90s. That's where I first met Gene when I was police commissioner there.
Yep. Thank you, Bill.
Certainly had that experience in New York where we tipped that city dramatically. Crime has been down 12 straight years. Unfortunately, it started going up this year. But here in Los Angeles, in one of the most understaffed police forces in America. I have so few police here versus elsewhere. We cannot do it by ourselves. We need to rely on those other elements. And particularly in this city, I think the ministers, the black ministry in particular, which has such influence in this city, can in fact play a key role. And that's what Gene is attempting to do, particularly Bishop Blake out here, who's a well-respected black church leader, to try and get the various communities that make up that black ministry. And it's a very diverse ministry out here between Baptists and Methodists and it is not one monolithic entity, as Gene is understands in his short time out here. But something has to be done. In a city with a 12% black population, where 44 to 46% of the murders are committed by blacks and 44 to 46% of the victims are black, that's four times the population of that community. So there's a problem there. And on the other hand, the Latinos, who make up about 40% of the city population, have about 40% of the homicides, and 40% of the homicides are committed by largely Latinos. So there's a balance in that community, but in the black community, it is totally out of whack in the sense of the levels of violence.
Chief, I want to go back to the list of words that you began with, the ministering, monitoring, mentoring, and enforcement, because the ministering and the mentoring, to be effective, really have to be in place and working for some period of time before there's any kind of an impact on the crime, on the enforcement side of it. I mean, is that something for you to get going, or is that something where you simply go to the Eugene Rivers of L.A. and say, people, you've got to do some work here?
Well, actually, I don't care where the catalyst comes from. That I'm very appreciative that Bishop Blake on his own had found Gene Rivers, that I was well aware of Gene. Gene and I work with John DiIulio on the Mentoring, Ministering, Monitoring project that both of us reference. But the catalyst is, if Gene is part of that catalyst, I'm certainly trying to be part of that catalyst here in Los Angeles, in that I've been very upfront in my discussions in the black community, Latino community, that I am not going to accept responsibility for the violence in those communities. It is a shared responsibility. And it's something I've been fortunate to find in this community. There is a willingness to share that responsibility. I don't see the black leadership, the black religious community, running away from ownership or shared ownership. What we're trying to encourage and incite is much more partnering in trying to deal with the problem.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that is refreshing is that you have individuals in Los Angeles like Mark Ridley Thomas, City Councilman Mark Ludlow and Lomax, and Reverend Bishop Blake.
Actually, I just left Mark about Ludlow, Gene, and he's looking to meet with you the next time you come out. So please make that a point the next visit out to.
Yes, sir.
Bring by to you. I mean, he's a city council member that will be coming into office on July 1st.
And let me just say this. And what is happening, which is part of the shift, is that they're saying we as the black community are going to own this issue. We will support Chief Bill Bratton in the enforcement piece of this. There is a recognition that violent criminal behavior must be suppressed, and there's no weaving and bobbing around the issue, and that there's a clear message sent to the young people that violent criminal behavior, black-on-black violence and death will not be tolerated, and that the black community is adopting a zero-tolerance attitude.
Chief Bratton, quick last question for you, if I can, and that is that back in 1992, there was that awful stabbing in the Morningstar Baptist Church. That,
right in Boston.
In Boston, it was a funeral, and the stabbing took place in the church, and that moment started that kind of shared responsibility. Everybody in this city said, no, that's just unacceptable.
Gene speaks to that as the epiphany, that was the...
But if you had your epiphany in L.A., are you going to have some bloody awful event like that to really get the people to sit up and pay attention?
We
have not had the moment for an epiphany. I think what has happened here is the sheer weight of events over time, the fact that last year, we were at the murder capital of the United States in the sense that we had more murders in this city than any other city. Although I'm happy to report that this year we are leading the country in the decline in the murder rate, that we're down about 23%. Homicides among gang members are down actually closer to 40%. So there was no single event in Los Angeles as there was in Boston, or I would argue in New York City. The epiphany there was a stabbing death of a young defending his family in the subways right. in 1991 when I was the chief of transit police there. And that was the beginning of the turnaround in New York City that was so effective. Here, I think it's just the events over the last 10 or 15 years where the murder rates just kept going higher and higher. But echoing Gene's comment, we are talking a percentage of the, there's about 100,000 gang members in the city, but clearly not all of them are engaged in violent acts. Otherwise, none of us would be able to live here because they'd be totally overwhelming. But there is a small percentage of those, 1, 2, 3%, who are sociopaths. They're people that literally have to be put away. But the vast majority of these kids, if you give them alternatives in their life, mentoring or ministering, or for that matter, cops who are controlling their behavior but doing it constitutionally, compassionately, and civilly, we can make a change.
You know, actually, Bill's sort of understating it. I think the major breakthrough in Los Angeles has been the presence of Bill Bratton. In other words, Bishop Charles Blake said, look, we had a conversation. I said, listen, I know Bill Bratton from 1991. He was fair. He was sharp. He was tough. We could do business with him. And he transcended the racial polarization that had preceded him. Bill Bratton's arrival in Los Angeles created a new opportunity for the black community to partner with law enforcement.
All and right, so Chief, I think there's a high bar for you to jump over. I'm going to let you go because we've got a bunch of other callers we want in.
Okay, thank you. Gene, good talking to you.
Talk to you soon, always. Chief.
Thanks so much for joining us.
Take
Chief
care.
Of Police William J. Bratton from Los Angeles, 1-800-423-8255. Back to the phones now. Rocky Mount, North Carolina. Ruby's on the line. Hi, Ruby.
Hi.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you for calling. Thank you for having this show. It's really a very important subject going on today.
I agree.
I am a African-American mother, and my son and I, we lived together for a couple of years without my husband. And I think that the young men of today, the black men, and I hate using the black and the white because it's like opposing issues. When this word black, yes, James Brown came out and said, I'm black and I'm proud. But I think what is happening now is that it is making an opposition of the Caucasian and the African American. And someone needs to start some kind of movement to eliminate black and white. Because when you talk about Hispanics, you say Latinos. When you talk about someone African-American, you say black, or you say white for someone that's Caucasian or Anglo-Saxon.
Ruby, can I go back to where you began when you were talking about your son? The dad was away for a while.
My husband was away for a while.
Are you saying there was a change?
And my son became, yes, very unruly, very out with gangs, with people that weren't good for him. And then when my husband came back and he decided to stay with us because, you know, he had some problems, and he came back into our home, and my son changed. There was more respect. There was more able to talk with him, to find out what's on his mind. And they were just, you know, that change was there. And I think our young black men need to have that kind of instill or that kind of mentoring or ministering, as the minister said, at a young age, and it needs to continue and be consistent.
Where does
these
it come
men
from?
Think that they come, that they have no, their lives do not exist.
Ruby, where does that come from if the dad's not there? Because in so many houses, the father's not there.
Well, I think it would have to come from the neighborhood. It would have to come from the church. It would have to come from the teen centers or you know, just some positive men that are in the neighborhood. It used to happen that way, where you did have the neighbors that were raising children in the neighborhood. But you don't have that today, and I think there's a lot of other issues that are happening with society in itself, causing the oppression. You know, there's large numbers of our men that are incarcerated. You know, they're there, and not all of them are criminals. Not all of them are sociopath, you know, killers. There are some that are in there because they had no other choice but to sell drugs. They had no job, so they had to go and do what they needed to do to feed their families, or, you know, and they were just down and out with no one to help them. And then we do have people who have boots, and they were able to pull themselves up by their bootstrings.
One of the stories that Gene Rivers tells is about going into just such a community and meeting, you know, the head gangster who says, "You're not here, I'm here. You're not here in the morning, in the evening, I'm here. I'm the one that the boys are seeing." And I don't know how easy it is. I don't mean to be gloomy or pessimistic about this. You know, to go to every street corner in South Central L.A. and find someone who's going to replace the person who is offering that, you know, life at a in the gangster world, you know?
But see, let's talk about this strategically, and I want to take your point. We don't need to go to every corner. All there needs to be is some evidence that there's genuine concern, and hope multiplies. We don't need, you know, I mean, we're
does
not...
It
does. Listen, look. 30 years ago, Boston was one of the most racially polarized cities in the country. I mean, it was we were the joke of the country, the butt of jokes about how racially polarized the town was. I mean, here was Boston, Athens of America, right, where it felt like Alabama for many black people. That's where Boston was 25, 30 years ago. The city has gone through a revolution. It is indisputably true. You know, it's not perfection. But the climate in this town is remarkable. In this city, we had the crack cocaine epidemic that created the explosion in violence. The city is dramatically different. We've got challenges, but there.
And you're saying that was just because there was someone not on every street corner, but someone in the neighborhood?
Look, it was a critical, you know, there were a few highly motivated. Look, in most entities, 90% of the work is done by 10% of the people. Now, if you're politically smart, you give the remaining 90% a lot of credit, or you got hell to pay, right? But that aside, all you need are, you know, in Los Angeles, there are young men. You've got two major politicians. You've got Mark Riley Thomas and Martin Ludlow in L.A. Those two young men represent the new leadership, the new paradigm. They can be the catalyst. You've got another revolution. You've got Reginald Hudlin and Byron Phillips, who are young, intellectual, sort of the conscious wing of the entertainment industry. They're now going to be teaming up with the churches and the police to develop strategies to look at the cultural violence which permeates the stupid wing of hip-hop. So, a critical minority of individuals. You see, most leadership is not done by the majority. It's always a critical elite, if it's in the foreign policy world, if it's in the corporate world, so it is in the communities.
Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
We should talk more about this.
Pleasure.
Reverend Eugene Rivers, pastor of the Azusa Christian Community in Dorchester, Massachusetts, founder of the National 10-Point Leadership Coalition. Earlier in the program, we talked with Jill Leovi, L.A. Times reporter, whose ongoing series, Mortal Wounds, chronicles the stories of black-on-black violence in Los Angeles. There'll be a link to those stories on our website. And we also talked with William Bratton, chief of police in Los Angeles. Connection listeners, we invite you to continue the conversation online in our forum section. We're at www.theconnection.org. Our senior producers, Tara Murphy, I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.